Yeah, 79 is the dances. And what parking lot was that at?
It's at
Marine Artist Studios Northwest, 2516 Northwest 29th.
All right. And that was June.
July 15th. Yeah.
Sorry about that. July 15th. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Pleasure.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 25th annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Music and Food Festival, June 23rd through June 25th at Lil's Albina Park in Portland. The Good in the Hood Music and Food Festival is the largest multicultural festival in the Pacific Northwest. This three-day music festival opens up with a community parade that travels through Northeast Portland and ends at Lil's Albina Park. The parade starts at 11 a.m. from King Elementary School on Saturday, June 24th, and ends at Lil's Albina Park, where there will be music, food, and resources while connecting people with experiences that strengthen unity in community. Again, that's the 25th Annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Music and Food Festival, June 23rd through June 25th at Lil's Albina Park at North Flint Street and Russell Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, the time is now 6 p.m. You're listening to Labor Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. I'm your host, Nick Bubb. With me tonight,
Michael Cathcart, as always.
As always, Michael, how are you?
Doing great. How are you doing, Nick?
You know, I'm doing pretty good. Things aren't going too bad. The sun's out. The sun's shining. I was able to call my dad and wish him happy Father's Day yesterday. So
good move.
Thank you to all the fathers out there. We definitely appreciate you.
It was a great sunny Father's Day and a beautiful Monday to start the week.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And so, of course, as always, we've got some labor-related news tonight. We've got some information on a Supreme Court case that's coming to bear.
Yeah.
This is something that's going to affect workers, and we're having a change of whether the federal government supports it or not.
Absolutely. It's basically, as we expected going into the Trump administration, it was pretty obvious that he and his administration would generally side or end up on the side of organized employers as opposed to organized labor, generally siding with the owners as opposed to the workers. And we have a case now that is basically no different than what we expected. There is a case that was basically brought to the National Labor Relations Board, and they ruled in favor of workers in a situation that, or basically discussing waivers for class action lawsuits brought by employees against employers. So it's a slightly complicated situation, but essentially a lot of companies are doing this now. They're including in the employment agreement that you sign before you start working for them, a section in there that basically says that by signing the employment agreement, you waive your right to engage in a class action suit for loss of wages or wage theft or anything like that, and instead you opt for binding arbitration on an individual basis directly with the company. So that's a lot of big words, but essentially what that means is you lose your right to bargain or to petition for redress against the company collectively, and you have to deal with them directly on an individual basis. And so you have to basically go one-on-one against them. You have to hire a lawyer, go one-on-one against them to arbitrate, a situation where maybe they stole wages from you, or they didn't pay you what you were expected to be paid.
Right.
And you don't have any collective element on your side supporting you. It's just you and your lawyer versus the corporate lawyers.
These things are taking over everywhere in all aspects of our lives. And I, for one, wish that the courts would not uphold them. I wish they would rule and say, this is not an enforceable agreement. You cannot require somebody to waive their rights. For instance, when I got internet, the only option that I had to get internet was Comcast. But in order to get Comcast, I also had to sign a waiver that I am waiving my right to bring a suit against Comcast class action.
Oh, really?
And instead have to resolve any issues through binding arbitration.
That's interesting that, yeah, it's not only, I mean, we're seeing this obviously in employment contracts around the country, but that's not the only place that this is existing. It's also existing in agreements like exactly what you said, you know, user agreements for different products or different services now. So if, you know, you sign up for, yeah, say Comcast, you know, for internet coming into your house, and say something happens where your information is sold by, or, you know, someone is able to hack the information from Comcast, you aren't able to bring a lawsuit against them. If that happens to you and 100 other users in your neighborhood or whatever, you have to go directly with them and arbitrate it with their legal team.
Yeah, like imagine like what happened with Wells Fargo. Was that last year now where they fraudulently opened?
It
like
was last year.
There was such sales pressure on their employees that they opened up a bunch of accounts, fictitious accounts, but in actual customers' names.
Right.
Like these people were facing the repercussions of having their credit report pulled.
Yeah.
Maybe even having money moved or vanishing.
Yeah.
And you know, and I'm not familiar with Wells Fargo. I'm not one of their customers at this time, but maybe maybe they also had to sign this kind of waiver, you know? So the question is, should this kind of waiver be mandatory? Should it be enforceable?
Right. Like in that case, if it were the case that the folks banking with Wells Fargo were required to sign a waiver like that while opening their account, despite the fact that this was a widespread issue where Wells Fargo was, you know, opening fraudulent accounts in the names of a lot of their customers, you as an individual were only allowed, you'd only be allowed to bring a suit against them as an individual, as opposed to collecting all those people together and bringing a larger class action case against the company.
Right. And in those cases, there's incentive that the firm will pick that up and represent you without cost you. If you go in arbitration all by yourself, you're on the hook. I mean, you're scared. Maybe you can't even afford a lawyer.
Right.
And if you don't have one, and more likely if you don't have a lawyer when you lose, then you're going to be on the hook for their legal fees as well.
And that's one of the things that was cited in a number of articles about this this reverse indecision. And I'll get back to that in a moment about the Trump administration's support on this. But basically, you know, if you are an individual and you're in need of a job, if you are in a situation where you may have lost your job, you may have been unemployed for a little while, and you get an opportunity to work for someone, they give you a contract to sign, you know, to work for them. If you're desperate enough, it's likely that you either are not reading that contract and no one's pointing out to you that this section and this clause exists, this waiver exists, or despite the fact that someone may have pointed out to you or that you may have read it, you'll still sign that contract because you still need that paycheck.
Right. When you're hungry, you're going to do what it takes to feed yourself and feed your family.
Right. And if you are an individual who then tries to bring a suit against them, I mean, if you are only doing it individually as opposed to in a class action setting, it's going to be hard for someone who was desperate enough in a situation where they needed the money badly enough to find a lawyer who would be willing to take that case on, despite the fact that it's, you know, likely you're not going to win because you're going to go up against a giant team of corporate lawyers. And then so to find a lawyer that would do it pro bono or to do it for a reduced cost is going to be very difficult. And for an individual employee to fund that case is almost impossible. Exactly. And so, you know, this creates a situation where it's, you know, it may not necessarily be forcing workers to accept this situation, but, you know, in the legal sense, but in reality, it is forcing workers to accept, you know, binding arbitration as opposed to, you know, and waiving their right to sue, to a class action suit.
Right.
And so the Trump administration, you know, reversed the decision of the Obama administration. Basically, the National Labor Relations Board, or the NLRB, took this case, you know, basically heard arguments from workers, took the case on, and basically made a ruling saying that these waivers were illegal. They were against employment law. That was what was supported by the Obama administration. Now with the Trump administration, they have come in and completely done a 180 on that. They reversed the position, siding with the employers as opposed to the employees. And we have a weird situation now where the Trump administration is directly contradicting its own labor relations board, the NLRB, which is under the purview of the executive branch. So the solicitor general who normally would argue this who take the case from the NLRB and argue it in front of the Supreme Court,
right,
is now actively arguing against it and is going to argue it against it. So the NLRB has said that they are going to put their own lawyer in the case and argue it to the Supreme Court. And they're going to be arguing most likely, I mean, very possibly against a team that would include the Solicitor General or a lawyer from the Trump administration.
Wow.
Which is unheard of.
That is. It's like mind-boggling.
Yeah. And
so, but this gets me to thinking, like, this is like, when I was younger, I would never have heard of an agreement like this or even imagine an agreement like this. But it makes me wonder what other really weird agreements are there in employment contracts. So, I mean, if you're out there listening right now and you got one for us, or maybe you just had to sign this very waiver to your right to bring lawsuit, call us up and tell us about it. The number's 503-231-8187. We want to hear about these employment contracts that you've got.
Hit us with that number again. Let's get that again.
503-231-8187.
There it is.
Now, the extra interesting thing in this case now is Trump's done the reversal from what the Obama administration stood for. He's siding with employers instead of employees. But doesn't he have a little bit of a conflict of interest in this case, being that he is a huge employer?
Yeah. And not only is it a conflict of interest because, you know, he or, you know, technically his sons, his family, his company in his name is a major employer that has had issues, you know, run-ins with the NLRB in the past. Specifically, his hotel, the Trump International Hotel in Las Vegas, is in a situation where they are being cited by the NLRB for wage theft issues for the employees at that hotel. So it's a strange situation set up where not only did the Trump administration reverse the decision and is going against its own labor relations board on the political side, but then in Trump's personal world, his company is now at odds with the NLRB, is arguing in court against them, and they're supporting the workers of his company. And he's, you know, his lawyers presumably are arguing, you know, against those workers and against his own labor relations board.
Right.
So it creates this like mind-boggling situation where he, in the political realm, is reversing precedent and turning against his own labor relations board. And then in his private personal realm, his business realm, he is also, he stands to benefit from reducing their power and having a decision made by them overturned in a different case. So it's just one of the many conflicts of interest that we all knew was going to happen with a businessman turned president. But
I mean, nobody likes this situation at all. I mean, I'm pretty sure during the primary we talked about the unfairness of the Clinton Foundation and how, like, just innately based on that, Bernie seemed more trustable to me. Like, he's not doing the pay to play thing. And then we get a step further, where a guy wields the power of the federal government, and in situations like this, one could think that he's using it for personal gain.
Yeah, and I mean, like, at this point, I don't think he's given us any reason to suspect that he's not doing anything for personal. I mean, he's doing everything for personal gain, is what I assume. It's pretty clear that he's running the administration as if he were, you know, a third world dictator, putting his family members in positions of power,
right,
you know, keeping power close to his office and to his chest and within the family, and then setting himself up, you know, the big picture plan seems to be for his administration and moving into the future post whatever his presidency is, seems to be setting himself up to benefit financially outside of the White House in the future by the power dealings that he does while president. So, I mean, this is, you know, on the grand scheme of things of just overwhelming corruption that's coming out of the White House right now, this is a relatively minor element, but it's very telling that this is already becoming an issue, you know, 3-4 months into his presidency, and this is a direct attack on organized labor and on workers, the workers in this country who he largely were his base and who he, you know, claims to represent and
right,
to speak for. So it's just another one of the giant hypocrisies that is Donald Trump as president.
So I remember it must have been his first week or two. They pushed in a bill for national right to work.
Yeah.
And then I've heard nothing more on this.
I know. It's Either it's being worked on behind closed doors, like everything else that the Republican-led House and Senate are doing, or it's just been put on the back burners because of the chaos that's ensued since his first day in office. Steve King, Representative Steve King from Iowa, put right to work, a national right to work bill, and put it into a vote, you know, or put it on the floor of the House. And that was, I think, within the first week of the Trump presidency. And it would basically do what has been done in a lot of states around the country, particularly Rust Belt states, which is to directly attack the power of organized labor and bring about right to work legislation nationally. And just for those out there who aren't sure, I mean, I'm sure if you listen to this show at all, you know what right to work is, but it's, I mean, maybe you can explain it to us a little bit.
So basically what it does is it says that you have the right to work without having to join any kind of organization. So right now, if you wanted to opt out of your union, you still have to pay, and it's different based on whatever the union says is the actual percentage of your dues that goes towards bargaining.
Yeah.
You still have to pay that amount, and then you lose out on your right to vote or anything like that as a part of the union. But in right to work, you can just opt out entirely and say, "Hey, I want to go rogue. I'll do my own thing." The problem is that the law actually still compels the unions to represent these workers, and those workers still get all the benefits that the people paying into the union get. So basically, it's like this. It's like you say, okay, well, I want all the benefits of being an American citizen, but I don't want to pay taxes anymore.
Yeah.
And then calling that the right to be a citizen bill. I mean, it's just a complete misnomer. I don't even think they should be able to call it right to work because it's not.
Yeah, it's
accurate.
It's right to work for less is what the opponents of it have dubbed it. You know, and it's a piece of legislation that really took off, you know, in the early part of, you know, around 2010. It was a big part of Scott Walker's agenda when he took office in, you know, the contested election in Wisconsin in 2010 or 2011. I forget exactly when that was.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically swept across the Rust Belt states, states, you know, like Michigan and Indiana, and all those states have enacted it already. And it's spread to, there's something like, it's like 26 states or I forget the exact number, but there's something like almost half of states in this country now have some form of right to work on the books there. And it creates a situation where it just completely undercuts and diminishes the power of organized labor because it forces unions to represent people who are not supporting them, you know, financially.
Mm-hmm.
And so it diminishes their support base, but it still requires them to exist and argue on behalf of people who aren't supporting them. And that's right to work itself is a piece of legislation that came to us from an organization called ALEC, or the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is it's essentially a giant right wing funded, you know, right wing billionaire funded forum in which you bring together legislators from, you know, states and cities and the federal government all around the country with lobbyists and representatives from major corporations, you know, lawyers, lobbyists and CEOs from major corporations and organizations around the country. And basically the lobbyists for these different industries and companies will write up like boilerplate pieces of legislation that would directly benefit them or their industry that they want to see passed. Then they'll, you know, bring it to they have these big conferences, you know, every year I believe it's every year, maybe twice a year, where they have, you know, it's opulent and they have this great food. It's you know, it's a wine and dine kind of situation where the lobbyists schmooze.
Do they sacrifice virgins at these events?
Yeah, I'm sure that happens after hours, you know. There's probably some sort of blood ritual there. But they basically, you know, get drunk with politicians and then bring them legislation. So they basically do their job for them. They're like, hey, this is something we want passed. We largely funded your campaign. Here is a completely written out piece of legislation for you. All you have to do is just write in your state's name here, write in your name here, and then put it onto the floor of the Senate or the House or whatever it is that you represent. If you're a governor, bring it to your state. and it does the work for you.
And then we'll make sure that you get elected next year.
Exactly.
And then we'll bring you another bill that'll get you elected the year after that.
Yeah. And so, so many things have come out of ALEC. One of the most notable is the Stand Your Ground Law, which is what George Zimmerman mm-hmm. used to justify his murder of Trayvon Martin, his unjustifiable murder of Trayvon Martin. And then, you know, that's been used in countless other situations since then.
Yes.
There's a lot of smaller or less known pieces of legislation that have come from ALEC, but Right to Work is another one of those. And that's a little bit more known because it's happened so many places around the country.
And of course, the other thing is that they love to hide behind ALEC, right? Because I'm not saying that Nike supports them. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. I'm ignorant of this. But suppose Nike did want to support Right to Work. They don't want to come out and say, I'm going to do that, because they know that me and you and anybody listening to the show and a bunch of other people that we know and our moms and dads and aunts and uncles and grandmas and best friends are never going to buy another pair of Nikes in their lives.
Right.
So they take all this money and they dump it into ALEC, and that benefits them. They can hide behind that. They're like, well, we didn't do that. ALEC did that. And then it also gives them a pool of money. So it's not just Nike's money. Then like all the other people that are backing these bills get to dump their money in there too.
Exactly. And yeah, I mean, so it creates a situation where there's just an endless supply of dark money funding these corporate driven pieces of legislation that then get passed on to legislators who don't consider their constituents' desires because they're being funded by these major lobbyists, and they pass it in the state despite what's actually best for the people of that state. And so it's, you know, basically law, like legislation coming directly from industry and being implemented.
You know, I've read that something like 70,000 people move to Portland every year now. So I'm wondering if we had anybody listening right now that's moved here from a state that's so-called Right to Work. Maybe you could call in and tell us what that experience was like. The number is 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Call us in and tell what you think.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you were in a labor union in Michigan or, you know, Indiana or Wisconsin. Maybe you weren't. You know, maybe you were someone who was benefited from this law or you know, opted out of the union. Or maybe you just know someone who worked in that situation. But we'd love to hear from you, hear your take on it. And spur the discussion even further.
So, but not all is lost. I mean, we have many states that have flipped over. They've succumbed to this Right to Work legislation. But there's some cases now where unions are fighting back. And you have a story to share with us about
Absolutely.
This.
Yeah, it's actually a really exciting story that's come out recently. That there are in Fairfax County, Virginia, which is a wealthy suburb of Washington, D.C., the bus system, the transit system in that city is, you know, it's organized by, or it's run by a private corporation. It's sanctioned by the county board, but it's run by a private company. And Virginia is a Right to Work state. The drivers, you know, the operators of this system were basically experiencing, they were represented by the ATU or the Amalgamated Transit Union. They had been experiencing, you know, when Right to Work came, a lot of folks opted out of the union, so the power of that union diminished heavily.
Right.
And as a direct result of that, the drivers saw their wages stagnate or in some cases go down. They saw their benefits diminish. They saw a degradation in the quality of work, or maybe their hours, you know, things like that, not getting break times and stuff like that. And so this, you know, this was happening for a while, and this really, this didn't sit well with the drivers. So they went from basically having a situation where folks had opted out of the union, and so you'd have something like, you know, five or six people show up in any given union meeting, to folks recognizing the need to band together and bargain collectively, and returning to the union, supporting it, funding it, and building back the strength of the ATU, so that now every you know, almost every driver in that system is a part of the union again, and they're in the process of negotiating a better contract with the company that operates their system.
And we're not just talking about pay; we're talking about all kinds of like working conditions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like what are the things that they're asking for and negotiating?
I mean, so there's things, I mean, obviously, you know, better starting pay, better increases in pay, better benefits, but also, you know, better scheduling for shifts, you know, so that you don't drive, you know, until something like, you know, say 11 o'clock at night and have to be back at 5 in the morning the next day to keep driving, or that you do get your mandated breaks, or the breaks that would be enforced when the union was stronger. And so it's basic, like, working condition elements as well as benefits and pay. You know, all those things are rolled in together to create the larger work experience. And so those are the things that they're fighting for, and that they now have a strong union to help represent them.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and like, I think, you know, some people still don't understand, like, the 8-hour workday. You're welcome. It's brought to you by the union.
Yeah.
The
weekend.
Yeah. Do you enjoy weekends?
Yeah.
No, you're welcome. It's brought to you by the union. You know,
like, not having kids, you know, as young as 5 or 6, having to work. Yeah. Thank you, union. Labor.
So one of these things in the labor notes article that we read, it's sharing some of the complaints that they have. You know, sure, they want, everybody wants to make more money. Everybody wants a better medical plan. These people had it even tougher, maybe. They said they'd work 10-hour shifts without a bathroom break.
Right.
They had bottles of water that were yellow on the bus because they couldn't stop to use the bathroom. That what kind of working condition is that? That is nonsense.
Right. Like, the driver
10 hours?
Being forced to drive straight. I mean, do you want to ride on a bus where the driver hasn't had a chance to take a bathroom break, has not had a break in 10 hours, 8 hours, 9 hours, and has just been driving? I mean, is that safe for the riders? Is it safe for the driver? Is it safe for the other people on the roads and the pedestrians? I mean, that's a recipe for disaster all around.
Yeah, and it's not like we're shorthanded, right? It's not like unemployment is zero. Like, there's people out there that want work. Can't we hire a couple more bus drivers and right. split it up a little bit so these guys and gals can have a bathroom break?
Yeah, I think that's maybe the least that could be done for them. I mean, so it's a situation where this is a small victory in a largely desolate landscape of attacks on
organized labor
and on workers, you know, brought about by not only the Trump administration, but also large industry and right-wing billionaire-funded efforts. And so just to tie things all in here, jumping a little bit away or back to where we were before, you know, obviously you can we know about what ALEC does, but there's a lot of folks who fund ALEC or who are major contributors to it, and we know about the Koch brothers. You know, they've been largely exposed, and people are aware of that name, and they know the impact that they've had on our political scene and our industry scene for a long time. But there are other organizations, other foundations that have been doing similar work that are still sort of shrouded in mystery. They're still behind the curtains. And the Center for Media and Democracy just recently put out an expose on a new organization, or not a new, they've been around for a long time, but they are just now being noticed or coming, it's been coming to light, the work that they've been doing. They're the Wisconsin-based Bradley Foundation, and they are, you know, another billionaire-funded. It's Lynd and Harry Bradley, basically a billionaire family, started a foundation that operates as a 501c3, so a tax-exempt charity nonprofit.
You're right.
So they, you know, they don't have to pay taxes, but under the rules of, you know, the IRS regulations, 501c3s are not allowed to engage in political work. You know, they are not allowed to fund political campaigns. But this organization, the Bradley Foundation, has essentially just been funneling money. You know, they're a clearinghouse for funneling money into Republican-led, you know, fights. So they've been cracking down on, they have been, you know, one of the biggest backers for the effort to crack down on organized labor in this country over the last, you know, couple decades. And we're just now hearing about them. But they're a major contributor to ALEC. They gave something like $1.1 million to ALEC, you know, over a two-decade period. And they, along with the Heritage Foundation that we've all heard of, you know, a Koch brother-funded organization, they were the other major backer of the right to work legislation being passed, you know, put into ALEC and then passed through mm-hmm. to legislators. And on top of that, they also contributed something like $20 million to the National Right to Work Defense Foundation, which is another foundation set up to continue to prop up and to push for right to work, national right to work legislation. So the Bradley Foundation is a name that we should all get very familiar with. You should look into them, see what other work they may be doing in your area. And specifically here in the Northwest, some of their biggest targets have been you know, not only teachers unions, but also public employee unions. And they've specifically zeroed in on the state of Washington as a battleground for them, as a place that they think they can make inroads. So if you are listening maybe over the river in Vancouver or anywhere over there, take a look, you know, see if any of the politicians are being funded by the Bradley Foundation, if they're taking up any legislation from them.
So we got about a minute left now, and yeah. I just want to talk about end on a positive note. So we faced some bad stuff coming down from the Trump administration. We know that the Affordable Care Act is going to change as we know it, and it's probably not going to be as good as what we have now. Even, however, states are fighting back. There's been a bill introduced in California to provide single-payer health care. There's also one that's passed the legislature in Nevada, and it's now going to the governor, or maybe it has, but I think it's still going to the governor for signature.
I think so, yeah.
And more interesting to me than that is Hawaii becoming the first state to introduce the universal basic income. This means whether you work, you don't work, whatever you do, you're going to get a basic amount of money every month. And I've always found this to be fascinating, because not only like do you not have to stress about getting laid off, but then also
we're done.
Well, we'll talk more about this next month. Universal basic income. Look into it. It's fair. I love that the tribes do it for their people, and I think that we could afford to do it for ours as well. We got the next show coming up here. I believe it's Prison Pipeline.
Yeah.
And so that's all that we have for Labor Radio this week. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Have a great night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification